I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A closed-door House committee investigation, dark money, and a felony indictment, there's certainly a lot of controversy and confusion surrounding Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. Today we'll talk with reporters covering the governor's woes about what exactly is going on in Jeff City and answer a few key questions about what it could all mean for Greitens' future. Then, in the aftermath of this week's tragic police shooting in Clinton, Missouri, we'll ask an emergency numbers expert about the technology involved in verifying where 911 calls come from. We'll also find out why landlines may be the best and fastest way to get police or fire personnel to your location. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. You'd be forgiven for feeling lost when it comes to the many controversies surrounding Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. He's faced multiple ethics-related investigations and now is under criminal indictment. We wade through it all with our political reporters in just a few moments. Later, continuing confusion over the events leading up to a Clinton, Missouri police officer being killed in the line of duty this week has us wondering how 911 systems actually work. We get some answers in our second half today. But first, a trial with critical national implications for voting rights enters its fourth day today inside a federal courtroom in Kansas City, Kansas. The case pits Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach against the ACLU, which is suing Kansas over the state's law that requires some new voters to show proof of citizenship when they register. The ACLU contends that that's disenfranchising thousands of would-be voters. Kobach says no, the law is needed to combat rampant voter fraud. Joining us live now from the courthouse is KCUR's Celia Yopis Jepson. Celia, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with what happened yesterday. The day ended with the judge admonishing Kobach's legal team. What happened there?
Yeah, yesterday ended pretty dramatically. The judge, Julie Robinson, was clearly very fed up. It was day three of the trial, and basically what's happened is over and over again, Kobach's legal team has tried to admit evidence in a way that violates trial procedure. The materials were not given to the other side, the ACLU, in advance. Kobach's side has it seems, been trying to endeavor to find different ways to include the evidence regardless. At one point, one of his lawyers simply tried to read it out loud. After being blocked from admitting it, and the judge stopped her and said, I'm not going to let you just read the contents into the record. She chided them repeatedly, saying this is evidence 101. They should know these rules.
And these issues, I gather, have been happening all week, Cecilia, with Kobach's side. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. We're on day four right now, and it has been a continued problem today so far.
From Kobach's perspective, he needs to prove that voter fraud is a real threat by showing that non-citizens are registered and voting on this massive scale. Has he been able to do that yet?
Not so far, but keep in mind, we still have multiple days of the trial. He's basically claiming, he says his best estimate is that there are probably more than 18,000 non-citizens on Kansas's voter rolls. That's a big claim that he has to prove, because so far he only has the names of about 43 people or so who are non-citizens on the voter rolls, and 11 of whom actually cast votes. So he's going to be relying on a lot of statistical projections. He has experts that will talk about statistical projections, and the ACLU will kind of attack those statistical projections as not reliable.
That's quite a disparity, 18,000 projected compared to 43 he's actually proven. I'm not missing anything there, right?
No, you're not. This is the big challenge here. And the higher court has already said in this case that he has to hit a higher bar. What he has so far is not enough for him to win his case.
Just one final point, Celia. Today, the court is preparing to show an excerpt of videotape deposition of Secretary of State Kobach. Why is that a big deal?
Well, that's a good question. We don't entirely know yet, because we don't know what excerpts are going to be shown in that video. What we do know is that Kobach's legal team, which includes himself, of course, he's representing himself, fought to not have the video shown. The ACLU seemed they were willing to not show this videotape of him answering questions about voter registration law if he would go on the stand, but he does not want to go on the stand and answer questions from the ACLU. It seems likely that in the video he will probably talk about seeking amendments to federal voter law through then-president-elect Donald Trump. Those potential amendments would effectively undermine the legal cases against him.
How much longer is this case going to go?
Right now, things are moving a lot more slowly than anyone anticipated. We're looking at, I think, at least through next Tuesday.
But we're having fun, right?
I think you'd need to, that depends on who you're going to ask in this building right now.
That's KCUR's Celia Yopis Jepson, live from Kansas City, Kansas. Celia, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
There's no question that Missouri Governor Eric Greitens is in a world of hurt right now as a House committee launches its investigation into allegations surrounding the governor's extramarital affair. But there's also been talk that St. Louis prosecutors who sought the invasion of privacy charge the governor now faces may be expanding their probe into other areas. Meantime, the Attorney General of Missouri has dropped one investigation and added another into the nonprofit that Greitens once founded. That's called the Mission Continues. That's a lot to swallow, and now a conversation that we hope clarifies what is rapidly becoming a murky mess. With us, Brian Ellison covers Missouri government for KCUR. He's host of the State House Blend Missouri podcast. Brian, always good to have you here.
Thanks, Steve.
Joe Mannies works for the St. Louis Public Radio and is a longtime political reporter in Missouri. Joe, nice to have you.
Well, thanks for asking me.
We hope to have Brian Houseworth with MissouriNet in just a little bit here. Brian Ellison, this is beginning to get real complicated, as I alluded to here. All these investigations of one Missouri governor, you almost need a flowchart to keep it all straight here.
It's really true, Steve. And some of them appear not to be related to each other at all, but the combined effect is pretty overwhelming. You've got the criminal indictment, of course, out of St. Louis, as well as the House committee investigation going on at the same time into some of the same things. As you mentioned, you've got the Attorney General's prior investigation into the use of a text messaging app. You've got a separate civil lawsuit being brought against the governor for possible violations of open records laws in connection with that. You've got other stories that come out about the campaign and the use of this donor list that came from the charity, the Mission Continues. You're absolutely right, Steve. There's a lot going on, and the governor is fighting battles on a lot of different fronts.
And just for the record, he continues to deny all wrongdoing here, any criminal wrongdoing, right, Brian?
In the case of the indictment, he has denied criminal wrongdoing. That's right, and has asserted that there is no evidence of this invasion of privacy charge that has been brought against him.
I think Brian Houseworth, now news director for MissouriNet's, on the line, and MissouriNet's a statewide radio network. Brian, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. We'll get Brian here in just a moment. Joe Mannies, let's start with the most, maybe the most obvious investigation going on now that's gotten the most attention, and that's the St. Louis prosecutor's investigation of the governor taking place in your backyard. This has resulted in a grand jury charge of invasion of privacy. So we've got a single felony charge that's been filed, and this is for what exactly, Joe?
Okay, most of your listeners probably know this by heart, but the bottom line is this. Greitens has admitted that he was engaging in an extramarital affair in 2015. And in March of 2015, this woman was in the basement of his house. She was tied up to some exercise equipment. She claims that she had blindfold on. She was, you know, not dressed. And he took some photos, or at least a photo. She could see the flash through her blindfold. This was without her consent. Now, she is not the one who's brought the complaint. It's the now ex-husband who had secretly recorded her while they were still married when he was pressing her for details on this affair. He frankly had been trying to circulate this with media outlets, at least in the St. Louis side of the state, for months. Then he ended up with this lawyer, Al Watkins. Okay, so then KMOV at Channel 4 finally decided to go with it. This was the ended up going with it on the day, or rather the evening, of the State of the State address.
Right, right.
I mean, this is like something out of a movie. And so the governor gives this speech, talks about ethics and all this, and within a couple of hours, all this is coming out on the 10 o'clock news that he's admitted to this affair. He admits, I mean, his claim is that any photo that was taken doesn't exist and that he never did anything illegal. I mean, there's kind of a different, his lawyers have tried different tacks. So in some cases, they were kind of hinting there wasn't a photo. Then it was, well, she can't assume privacy if she's engaging in an affair with him, and that she shouldn't presume this. So it's kind of murky back and forth. Now, the indictment papers make pretty clear. Many of us know who she is, so we know her initials.
Mm-hmm.
So her initials, let's put it this way, are listed as someone who did testify before the grand jury. Now, there is no confirmation of that, but the initials indicate that she and the ex-husband both testified before the grand jury.
But, Joe, just to be super clear here, she has not spoken to reporters. She has not spoken publicly yet that I'm aware of.
No, she has not. Now, she has spoken through a lawyer who I talked to a couple months ago, and he just said that she was upset that all this was out. She was upset that her ex-husband had done this recording without her knowledge. So, I mean, in short, she was recorded without her knowledge, and she may have been taken a photograph of without her knowledge.
And I think we should add that the governor has very carefully worded his responses to when he's been asked directly about whether there was a photo. He has not denied that there was a photo. He has said no criminal action, or there was no blackmail, or there was no threat with a photo. He never has denied taking the photo. And the indictment essentially is that he took the photo and then made it transmittable in some way by computer.
Joe Manis, has a trial date been announced here?
Yes, it's May 14th, which is interesting because it's right around the time of the end of the legislative session.
But not so, as late yeah. as the prosecution wanted it to be, which was in November, right around the time of the midterm elections, which would have been also very interesting.
So we have a couple months to go, Joe, before we're going to see this thing in a courtroom, perhaps, unless it's delayed, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, there have been all sorts of speculation. I mean, there had been... some of it I'm not going to go into because I think it's improper, but there's been some speculation that there might be an attempt to change the venue, to move it over to your side of the state. There has been...
We don't want it, Joe. Keep it over there.
Okay. Well, speak for yourself, Steve.
Yeah.
There's been, people have been speculating about whether or not there's more women who might come forward, but I want to emphasize, this woman never came forward. So, I mean, it's... It's kind of a complicated case from that standpoint. And in fact, the lawyer for the ex-husband has announced a news conference this afternoon where he's going to highlight. He's claiming that the governor's side is violating her privacy. And and of course, the governor, by the way, has been attacking the circuit attorney for weeks. And some of the releases they have been put out have been extremely strongly worded. And there's several Republican legislators, particularly some who are lawyers, who have said publicly that they wish the Greitens camp would quit that.
Hmm.
There's been some harsh words. Shaman
right.
Dogan, for example, who's a lawyer and a state rep from this side of the state, has publicly – he's also called for the governor to step down, but he has also said, you need to quit this, insulting the circuit attorney like this.
Brian, I want to clarify just a couple points here just to make sure everyone's on the same page. So the woman has not come forward publicly.
That's right. She has, in fact, asked for privacy.
Okay. She did not file a police report that we're aware of over this whole thing.
Not that we're aware of, which is a point that Greitens attorneys have made, that supporters of Greitens have raised, that where's the police report? Where's the usual police investigation that would accompany allegations of a criminal action?
And based on media reporting, the affair continued shortly after the photograph was taken?
According to Governor Greitens' own admissions, it continued into the fall. So into October, I think, is what he has said, after this alleged incident happened in March.
Which, by the way, is interesting because he formally declared his candidacy in September.
Right. Okay,
and a final point here, there was a story in the newspaper that the prosecutors don't now possess the photograph, if I understand correctly.
That's right. So, and that news first came in open court from Greitens' attorneys, who said in open court that the prosecutor had told him that the photo doesn't exist. And the prosecutor had to stand up and say, I did not say that. What I said is that we don't currently have it, but we believe it exists and we intend to get it. Again, the prosecution is maintaining there was a photo, but they have said in open court that they don't have it.
Brian Houseworth is now with us from Missouri Net, the statewide radio network. Brian, you there?
I am here.
I'm glad to have you there. You guys aren't lawyers. You're journalists, but I can't help but ask this question. And Brian Houseworth, I'll direct it to you, but anybody can jump in. Given what we just covered, what we just talked about here, do we have a sense of how strong this case is?
Well, it's, again, I think a lot of it's going to boil down, guys, to the photo. I mean, you know, that's a big deal. Obviously, Ed Dowd's focusing on that, the former U.S. attorney, and I expect Scott Rosenblum as well. But from the governor's perspective, though, another thing that he's got to be strongly concerned about is this investigative committee that is meeting in Jefferson City, and the vote was 154-0. So he's not only dealing with the court case, which is obviously huge, and Joe and Brian have touched on Al Watkins, apparently going to have a news conference today, but the committee here in Jefferson City is going to meet again today at 1:00 at the Jefferson City Police Station. It will be a closed session. We know that the governor will not be a witness, and the reason we know that is the governor is in the boot heel today for the big Noranda aluminum, now magnitude 7 announcement. So that's something we're going to have to watch closely, but again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not comfortable saying how strong the case is, but I can tell you, obviously, Dowd is focusing on the fact that right now, they say they just don't have the photo right now. However, as Brian pointed out, they countered that by saying they intend to get it.
Brian Ellison explained this to me. Brian Houseworth just mentioned the House committee's meeting today. Why is a House committee investigating this case when you have the St. Louis prosecutor's office investigating this case?
Yeah, Steve, they're two separate things. There's a criminal offense that he could go to jail for, but there's a completely unrelated process, which is in some ways a political process of elected officials deciding whether this other elected official can continue to hold office or needs to be censured or suffer some other reprimand. In this case, remember, the House committee can bring articles of impeachment on a different evidentiary standard. They don't have to prove that he committed a crime necessarily to bring articles of impeachment. Now, I will say that the chair, Representative Jay Barnes of Jefferson City, has suggested that what they are investigating is whether he committed the crime. But the truth is, they could impeach him for all kinds of reasons if they felt like he had done something that made him now unfit to govern. He could theoretically not be proven guilty in a court, but still be impeached, as of course we've seen happen to a number of elected leaders over the years.
Or he could be found guilty in court and not be impeached,
well,
right?
Well, that is interesting. I think theoretically, Steve, yes, that's possible, although one of the grounds for impeachment in the Missouri Constitution is the commission of crimes. And so I think it would be a stretch for lawmakers not to impeach the governor after if he were convicted of a felony, but it is, I guess, theoretically possible.
Now, top aides to Governor Greitens were called in last week to testify. Brian Houseworth, this was in connection with the St. Louis prosecutor's case. Do we know why they were asked, what they were asked and what was discussed during that testimony?
Are you talking about in St. Louis specifically?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't have the specifics on that. I haven't seen any accounts on that. Obviously, we focus on what's going on in Jefferson City. So I don't know the answer to that. The one point I would make, Steve, in getting back to what Brian said, Brian is correct. I mean, they could theoretically go and look at some other things. But Jay Barnes and Joe Manis was at the Capitol the day Jay Barnes said this when they announced it. He spoke, by the way, less than 3 minutes. He made it very clear that the committee will focus, quote, on the underlying facts of the indictment and the circumstances surrounding them, end of quote. And he would not elaborate, but the way I take it is it's not, you know, in other words, we're not looking at dark money or some other stuff Rob Schopf's talked about. It's just this case. And he was very clear. That's a direct quote.
Okay, but it's also clear, maybe we should move ahead here, Joe Manis, that the St. Louis Prosecutor's Office has at least hinted that its investigation may go beyond this extramarital affair and the photograph and the alleged blackmail here. What do we know about that?
Well, they have put out these hints that they may be looking at different aspects. They haven't really talked so much about the Confide app controversy, which are these text messages that disappear right after you read them. But I think they're looking for connections. I mean, okay, because one of the things, if there's blackmail or if there's and again, none of this is proven. Some of this is just swirling out there. But the governor has several of these nonprofits that raise money from undisclosed donors and spend money in undisclosed ways. And, of course, now there's two defense committees set up, I mean, that are also raising money that at least immediately don't have to identify their donors.
None of this is unusual, right, Joe? Lots of politicians across the country these days do the same thing.
Correct. But this is relatively new in Missouri. But in this case, what I think they're looking at is if there's some sort of connection. I mean, if there's some sort of any money that maybe ended up going to this woman or women, I suspect that that's what they're looking at to see if there is some sort of connection. I want to emphasize, I'm not saying there is, but that's something that's been swirling for months. So I think that that's where they could legally say, well, we think there might be a connection, so we want to check to make sure there is or isn't.
Right.
I mean, it isn't unusual, Steve, for a grand jury investigation or a prosecutor's work to take it in an unexpected direction. You follow the chain of evidence. You find something else that makes you ask another question.
That's what grand juries do.
That's exactly right. And so, there are political layers here that makes this a little more complicated than your typical grand jury investigation. But that is not unprecedented or even unusual for an investigation to lead from one thing to another.
If you just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're trying to untangle all the various investigations right now surrounding Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. Brian Houseworth, again with MissouriNet. Let's go back to the House committee that's investigating the governor. It's being led, I think Joe mentioned this, that it's being led by Representative Jay Barnes. Tell us about him, because he has a pretty solid reputation. He's a Republican. He's a four-term Republican in the state house. Tell us about him and how much faith maybe we can have in him.
Yeah, well, I've known him. I actually started my career in sports and news at KLIK in Jeff City, and I called a lot of his high school basketball games. So I've known him for 20 plus years. Prominent attorney here in town. He is somebody who is well respected on both sides of the aisle, somewhat of a maverick occasionally. I mean, for instance, on the gun bill, and I think Joe and Brian were both down in the 2016 veto session where Jay Nixon vetoed a gun bill and the Republicans overrode it. Jay Barnes was one of the few. In fact, I think there was only one other Republican that got up on the floor and urged people to sustain Governor Nixon's veto. So, and by the same token, he had been critical of him quite a bit during MamTech. He led the MamTech investigation.
So he's a little bit independent, you're saying, Brian.
I absolutely, in somewhat of a maverick. I mean, generally a reliable Republican vote, but you won't hear Gina Mitten or Gail Beatty say anything bad about him. They respect him. And the thing about him, too, is when I was at the organizational meeting, Steve, on Tuesday night here in Jefferson City, the whole meeting took all of about 4.5 minutes, and a lot of that was cameras getting set up in the room. The bulk of what he talked about was about there were too many television cameras in the room. He only wanted one. He wants a feed, and he made it very clear to the reporters in the room that you won't get any leaks out of me, you won't get any interviews out of me or any members of this committee, and that they will not say anything or even give a hint of anything until the end of the public report. There may be another one or two, we'll have to see, kind of public sessions, but he made it clear that if there are, they'll be open. Everything else is going to be closed. But I will tell you, he's respected in the building by both sides of the aisle. And Gina Mitten, and I think this is significant, when he was saying we're going to close these this meeting and we're going to move them to JCPD, the two Democrats were on board with that. There was no opposition. It was 7-0. That's huge.
Joe Manis, I want to wrap up this leg of our conversation here about the St. Louis Prosecutor's Office investigation and the House investigation, just to talk about timing very briefly here. It's possible, I assume, that the House investigation could then wrap up a lot sooner than the Prosecutor's Office case that doesn't go to trial maybe for a couple months or even longer. Does that make sense?
Yes, in many ways it does. They were hinting, I mean, Barnes and House Speaker Todd Richardson, although they didn't give a specific timetable last week when they announced the formation of the panel, the implication was that this was going to take a few weeks, not going past the court date. Now, they didn't say that, but it was just kind of the implication. And so I think that's something that people, and that would make sense, because they're going to be looking at this. This House panel, but again, like we've said, Representative Barnes is keeping the focus narrow, and I think that they don't want this to linger too much. I mean, because the House and Senate have other things they got to do over the next few months.
Okay, then if that's the case, Brian Ellison, is it possible that we could have a move to impeach the governor before the St. Louis prosecutor's case even goes to trial?
It is entirely possible. And how that will play out, again, as a partly political process, I think is going to be very, very interesting, Steve.
I mean, this is breathtaking. I mean, yeah. There's just so much.
Well, and unprecedented. That isn't just your judgment. That is the judgment of the whole history of the state of Missouri. There's never been a governor brought up on impeachment charges. Impeachment of any official is few and far between. It hasn't happened since 1994 with Secretary of State Judith Moriarty.
Brian Houseworth, let's wrap this up. Let's turn to what the Attorney General is doing here, because now he's engaged as well. He just dropped one investigation into the governor. What was that? And then what's the new investigation he's picked up?
Well, they're I think talking to people in the office, but you're talking about the Confide app,
right?
And that has to do with the Confide app that folks in the governor's office have apparently been using, and you know, as Joe mentioned, supposedly deletes messages after that they're read. I'm not quite familiar with it. I've had to learn a lot about that, because I wasn't even familiar, never even heard about that app until it came out. Jason Hancock's the first time I read that, but he's obviously doing his own. But for the governor's position right now, he's got to be concerned with that. But this House investigation's huge, and then the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's investigation is huge as well. They are meeting today, and I believe I looked at the calendar this morning. I believe, Steve, the bipartisan, it's called the House Special Investigative Committee on Oversight, looks like they're going to have a meeting in here in Jefferson City on Monday as well. And again, 40 days is the time frame that actually came up. That was part of the discussion. Nick Marshall from Parkville, who's a state representative,
right,
his concern would be, what happens if we get close to the adjournment date this year, which I want to say is May 17th, somewhere in there. It's the middle of May. It's a little longer this year. And he was basically told, we'll take care of that. So that really was something he was worried about. What happens if we're still trying to do this and the legislature adjourns? And it sounds like they don't think that'll happen, or maybe they'll extend it.
Brian Ellison from KCUR. So the investigation that the Attorney General, Josh Hawley, has picked up is what?
So he dropped the investigation into the Confide app, said that he couldn't find evidence of wrongdoing, which is not the same thing as exactly clearing the governor of any wrongdoing. But of course, the app destroys the text messages, so they didn't really have evidence. But the investigation he's picked up is into the use by the Greitens campaign prior to his election of a donor list that was obtained from the charity that was founded by Eric Greitens, called The Mission Continues. We already know that they had this donor list improperly. That came out in a Missouri Ethics Commission consent decree last year, so the campaign signed off on it. We know they had the list. We don't know how they got it. The investigation now is into exactly what went on and whether any laws might have been violated in that process. We know that they had this donor list. It was people who gave money to this charity, and that should never have gone into the hands of a political campaign. Something happened, and that's what they're investigating.
Hey, Joe Manis, given all this, can the General Assembly get anything done this session? Is it possible?
Well, I think that's one of the big questions. I mean, as all of us know, I mean, the governor has a lot of enemies within his own party, but for other reasons, for policy stuff, for using his dark money to run attack ads against some lawmakers. So I think it does make it more difficult for the governor to advance his agenda, for sure. And I think, yeah, it does. One of the state senators from this side of the state said that the Senate's, quote, walking on eggshells, unquote, and being very careful about what they do because they're watching what's going on in the House. They don't want to be messing things up. I think, yeah, I think it does stymie some stuff. And I think it's telling that the governor has been traveling around the state doing these photo ops, doing good things. Most of them have been closed to the press. No announcement ahead of time. He just posts these pictures on Facebook. So it's like he's basically spending most of his time outside Jeff City. So it's not like he's lobbying for stuff. So, yeah, I think it's going to be intriguing to see what, if anything, gets done in the next few months.
Brian Houseworth, there have been calls for his resignation. He has said over and over again he's not doing that. Any indication today that he could be changing his mind, or is that something that is still seems to be off the table?
Oh, it's off the table. He's not going to resign. That's just my sense. I think he's prepared to fight this out. I mean, they've added Scott Rosenblum to their defense team. It's the first time, Joe can correct me if I'm wrong, I've never seen Ed Dowd and Scott Rosenblum on the same team. Dowd, the former U.S. attorney, and Rosenblum, high profile defense attorney. So they've added that to their team. The my sense from the governor is he is prepared to fight this out. And to touch on what you also just said, the agenda for the governor, he didn't really lay out much during the state of the state address. It was kind of just some basic things that he laid out. But he has done a few things, and one thing he is doing today, and it is a public event. I mean, I've reported it, and the public's invited, so there'll be news media there. But Joe's right, it's down in the boot heel. It will be at the New Madrid aluminum smelter, and they're expecting hundreds and hundreds of people. The governor is going to be there. I believe Senator Doug Leibla is scheduled to be there. I haven't talked to him. I did speak to Representative Roan. Governor and Leibla have battled on a few things, and Leibla actually called for the attorney general to investigate the governor when this came out. But the governor is doing a public event today, but there's certainly no indication on my end that he plans to resign. He's prepared to fight it out. In fact, Kip Kendrick, who's the House Minority Whip, a Democrat from Columbia yesterday, he had the press conference for the Democrats. Normally it's Gail Beatty and Gina Mitten, but they didn't come up. It was Kip Kendrick. He predicted that right now things are fine, but he said things in this committee are going to get ugly. And I pressed him. I said, what do you mean get ugly? He said, attacks will be made. And I said, by who? And I pressed him, and he finally answered. He believes that the governor's allies will start to attack people. That's, again, him saying it, not anybody else, him being Kip Kendrick. And he bases that on what he says is the governor's track record during the session last year. But that's, again, what Kip Kendrick had to say yesterday. But right now the committee has been bipartisan, and Jay Barnes was the only one that even spoke the other night.
Oh, so you're talking about the committee that's investigating the governor, that the House committee. Is that right, Brian?
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
And just to wrap this up, Brian Ellison here from KCUR, the impact on the governor himself and his political future. Do we know how he's weathering this? Do we know if he's still thinking about running for president?
Well, you sure don't. You don't see much indication of that at this point. As Joe said, it's not that the governor isn't doing anything. He is putting out these press releases. But his agenda is no longer dominating. You know, it's not that the House and Senate aren't doing anything. The House has passed literally dozens of bills over the last couple of weeks. The Senate passed a big bill about raising the minimum age for charging a minor as an adult. There's legislation happening. There's an agenda passing. It's not the governor's agenda anymore, though. Does he have a future? Possibly, but it isn't looking so bright.
We're going to leave it right there. That's Brian Ellison from KCUR. Joe Manis works for St. Louis Public Radio. Brian Houseworth, news director for MissouriNet. Thank you all for a very interesting conversation. Good luck covering all this, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the 911 system really works and what happened this week down in Clinton, Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Prasky. Earlier this week, we learned how and why Americans react to problematic public art and what makes certain monuments so controversial. You can find that discussion and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, we take a look at the swell of social activism being spearheaded by teenagers. Dr. Wes Crenshaw tells us what conversations you should be having with your kids if they want to get involved. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this week's fatal shooting of Clinton, Missouri police officer Christopher Morton is being linked to incorrect information from a 911 call. CNN has reported that a computer system traced the call, during which no one spoke directly to a dispatcher, to Clinton instead of Windsor, and then went on to cite Missouri Highway Patrol Sergeant Colin Stossberg, who offered that the error was likely due to a glitch in the 911 call technology. Our calls to the Henry County Emergency 911 Center and to the Missouri Highway Patrol with requests for more information here about that call have not been returned. But to get a better idea of the technology of 911 call systems, we've reached out once again to Mark Fletcher. He's a certified emergency number professional with Avaya. That's a company that specializes in software and services for communication centers. He was with us last week to explain swatting calls for us. And Mark, thanks again for coming back. We appreciate it.
No problem, Steve. I appreciate you having me.
Let's walk through the possible scenarios here for a 911 call coming in. Clinton, Missouri is located in Henry County, whose 911 center is touted as the most up-to-date in the state, but we don't know the particular technology used there, so we're talking some generalities here. First off, how big a mystery is this 911 situation in Missouri, in the 911 world around the country right now?
Well, the main problem, Steve, around the country is the way the 911 works varies. There's so many different variables to it. How the call originates, where it's going into, what equipment is installed, what information is available based on the device, based on the location. There's so many variables, it's almost impossible to say this will happen in any given situation.
But do emergency professionals around the country, are they wondering what happened here? Is this a topic of conversation?
It's being discussed. I mean, and different things are being theorized. But as you said, there are missing pieces to the information that are critical to determining what actually happened.
Well, last night, KSHB-TV here in town reported that the Clinton 911 call came from a landline, which we have not been able to independently verify. But you say landlines are best replacing 911 calls from a dispatcher's point of view, and I'm wondering why.
Well, you know, here's the thing, Steve. When the phone company hooks up your phone at your house, it's at the end of a specific pair of wires, and they know that phone number and they know the installation address. That goes into a special database, and that database is what's accessed when a 911 call is placed. They take your phone number, they cross-reference it and say, oh, that's Steve Kraske's address, 123 Main Street. And that's what's used to dispatch the call on a landline.
So there's a certainty attached to landlines that might be missing from cell phones. And we'll get into that in a minute, right?
Yeah, I would say landlines are probably, there could be an error, but more often than not, they're going to have accurate information.
And the trick right now in 911 world is that there are fewer landlines being used than there used to be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I saw some recent numbers that were just scary about the number of people that are dropping their landline services or moving away to other pseudo landline services.
Okay. Things get trickier then. Let's turn to cell phones, because while there may be an address associated with the cell number, the phone obviously could be anywhere, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a big misnomer. And there's a lot of misinformation that's out there as well. So the fact of the matter is when you place a 911 call on a cellular device, and by the way, this is valid whether you've got a service plan or if it's a non-service initialized phone, just an old cell phone with no service. FCC requirements demand that any wireless provider provides that phone with a connection to the 911 system. And that's where it gets really convoluted.
And it's convoluted at that point. Why?
Well, first of all, the phone. So my cell phone, I have a New Jersey number. I live in New Jersey. I could go to your area tomorrow and make phone calls. I still have my New Jersey number. So when I make a cellular call, something's got to determine where that call needs to go and what information is displayed to the 911 center.
And that's where
a lot of that comes from the tower.
Yeah, I was going to say that's where cell phone towers come into play here. They have what you describe as cell faces. Explain that to me, and how many, and what do they do?
Well, think of a tower that's out in the middle of a field, and it's got a big coverage area, like a big circle, like a large pie. And that pie is split up into three distinct pieces called sectors. Now, each sector is then mapped by the cellular company, and they say, well, this particular agency services most of this sector. So calls coming in from here are more than likely going to be destined for this particular agency. And that determines what the routing is by what antenna face you hit. And that can get complex when they're on a mountaintop and on a state line. And there have been fatalities that happen there that are in the news as well.
So how does the tower then wind up knowing where to send a 911 call?
Well, I know that you came in off of this antenna sector, so I know that you're over to the west. And the cell tower has a database that says this particular police department services the bulk of that sector. The sectors aren't very large. They're actually fairly small. So more often than not, that sector will be serviced by one agency. And that's where the call is sent to.
How are dispatchers then able to identify that the call they're getting is, in fact, from a cell tower?
Well, each one of these sectors has a special number, an automatic number identifier, or ANI, as it's referred to in the industry. And when you make a phone call, from any phone, you have an ANI. We all call it caller ID in the public. Cell towers have numbers assigned to those cell faces, and those are called PANIs, or pseudo ANIs. And those pseudo ANIs are fairly specific. They're not really a dialable number, but to a local dispatcher, they know that the PANIs in the area on the towers, they recognize them. They actually get it on the screen. This is Verizon cellular tower at this address.
And that's how
they know.
The fourth, fifth, and sixth digits in these numbers you just alluded to are key here because they identify it as a cell number, right?
Yeah, if you looked at them, they would look a little strange. Might say 511 for the local exchange or something. But they'll have they're special non-routable numbers that exist, and their only purpose is to route phone calls that come in off that cell tower face.
You know, this all sounds really complicated to me as we talk here about 911 technology in the wake of the shooting of Officer Christopher Morton down in Clinton this week. You know, but all this happens pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Oh, it's almost instantaneously.
Okay. And at times, there are reasons to rebid, or it's a request for more information. What is rebidding, and when does that come into play here?
Well, there's different phases of cellular location. So phase zero, the initial phase, is when the call comes in, and the dispatcher is going to pretty much see the tower information. Now, almost immediately, in most cases, they will receive phase one data, which will include the callback number of the cellular device, the actual number of that device, and some cell sector information. This is in the north sector of this tower. When they rebid, and they can do this typically within 15 to 20 seconds, they can rebid or re-query the cellular network. And in that 15 or 20 seconds, the cellular network has used their technologies, radio triangulation, maybe queried the device for some GPS coordinates, and they come up with a better, more accurate location for that device.
I was going to say, typically speaking, how accurately can cell phone companies determine where a certain phone call came from a cell phone?
You know, again, it depends. So there are times when you can get excellent location resolution. If you have a GPS signal that's good and clean, you have to be outdoors to have that, by the way. If you're close to a large commercial area with a lot of public access points, McDonald's and Starbucks and, you know, all of these other companies that offer Wi-Fi, there are databases that actually track those locations. So there's a combination in your phone. If you have GPS, you have cellular service, you have the Wi-Fi location, the technology actually exists. And we've seen this with apps from like Uber. They can get it down to within 1 meter. The cell company is looking from the towers towards the device. They can't always get that explicit device information on the cell phone, and they have a much wider area of accuracy, which could be several hundred meters or more.
But it sounds like if you do a rebid that you can pinpoint a cell phone in most cases, as you're saying, within a meter or two.
Well, so the rebid process doesn't get all of that information off the phone like the new systems that are coming out have that aren't deployed here in the U.S. The rebid will get the cellular company's opinion of where your device is. And that's the problem. Your device actually knows where it is. And that's why Uber and Domino's know exactly where to send the car or deliver your pizza. Because the device, think of a peephole on a door. If you look in, you can't really see much. But if you look out, you get a very wide view.
Mm-hmm.
So the cellular company is looking into that device. It's where they think you are. The device has all the other information by looking out and can be extremely accurate. That technology is starting to come to the U.S. It's actually deployed over in Europe in over 10 countries.
So what's your sense here then, you know, as you look at this situation, you know, Mark, what happened? What's your theory?
Well, you know, there's several theories. So to, again, a lot of what ifs. So if it did come in on a landline, and again, people will use these terms loosely. So it may have looked like a landline, but it might have been a voice over IP service, mm-hmm. like Vonage or something. And those services, you can be anywhere. And when the query is made for the address on those, it's going to be whatever you entered when you bought the service.
So in other words, I could have a phone like that. I bought it in Chicago, but now I'm in Clinton, Missouri, which is what we're talking about here. And the dispatcher wouldn't have any idea when a call from a voice over internet protocol call came in. You'd have no idea.
Steve, there was someone who bought a Vonage phone who was stationed in the military. I think they lived in Texas. They got redeployed in Asia and brought the phone with them. They had a heart attack one day. The wife picked up the phone, called 911, got Texas 911 because that's where the network was told the phone was located.
Okay.
So theory number one
might be that a voiceover phone was used in this case.
Yeah, could be.
Okay. What's another theory you have here?
Could be a burner phone. You know, again, we don't know that it was. Well, a burner phone is a phone that you go to Best Buy and you just buy a phone with no plan on it. It's just a cell phone. And people will buy these for emergency use because 911 will work. Or they'll put them on one of their other plans. But the phone has no plan. That's capable of dialing 911.
Wow. What might be a
and
third?
That's problematic.
What might be a third theory here?
Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, there's so many. Anything could have happened. You know, someone said there's a database glitch. I hate it when people say, oh, there was a 911 glitch. You know, computers don't really glitch. I've been doing computers since the mid-80s. Computers do exactly what they're told to do. And that's the problem. We don't always tell them to do the right thing. So, yes, database glitches could happen. But they're very rare and very unlikely.
We're talking here about the murder this week of Clinton, Missouri police officer Christopher Morton, and why officers in Clinton were sent to a wrong address here involving Windsor, Missouri. The whole thing remains a mystery as we walk down the road from this fatality, this very unfortunate event just a few days ago. You were saying there are systems in Europe, Mark, that can locate a cell phone's location to within a single meter. Tell us a little more about them.
Well, you know, again, you know, here in the U.S., if you've used Uber or you've ordered a pizza, those services know exactly where you are. And that's because those services are typically using an app on the phone, or you're on a web page that's talking to your phone and looking at that information. So they use that same architecture, if you will, provided by Google and Apple on Android phones and Apple iOS phones, which cover most of the phones out there. And the 911 system, or it's actually 112 in the European countries, but when you dial 112, they use this new type of mechanism, and it's called AML, Advanced Mobile Location. And it's simply a query to the phone. Hey, where are you? What's the information you have? So you make a 112 call, the phone routes the call based on where it is, but then it puts this location information up into the cloud. And then when the emergency center gets your call, they query the cloud. Oh, hey, Steve just called 911. Where's Steve? Based on what Steve's phone says. Now, Google just ran a trial of this. In the U.S., they turned it on, didn't even tell people. And they compared the results.
Mark, I got 30 seconds left. Missouri voters have rejected attempts to have 911 surcharges added to their phone bills. The last attempt came in 2002. It was to create a statewide 911 emergency system for cell phone users. Would you recommend that to us?
Well, you know, the funding is great, but the funding's got to go somewhere. And there's so many – when I sat on an FCC committee, we found that so many states were diverting funds for other use. And, you know, in some states – New Jersey, my state, is horrible. I think a couple of percent of what was collected actually went to 911. So fees are okay, but they got to go where they're intended.
That's Mark Fletcher. He's an emergency numbers professional with Avaya. Mark, I sure appreciate the good explanation. Thanks so much.
No problem, Steve. Thanks.
Monday on the show, psychologist Wes Crenshaw is back. He'll let us in on what conversations parents should be having with their teens who want to be involved in social activism. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.